morning and welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on Worldwide KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by the Lutheran Church Extension Fund, where your investments help support the work of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Monday, November 11th, we're studying Numbers chapter 32, verses 1 to 42. In today's text, some of the people of Israel began to receive their inheritance of land already on the east side of the Jordan River. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us regular guest, Pastor Rick Jones. Pastor Jones serves as chaplain and vice president of spiritual life at the Dakota Boys and Girls Ranch in Minot, North Dakota. Pastor Jones, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me back. It's always a good time.
Give us some context as we get started. What should we know about Numbers and what's been happening leading up to chapter 32?
First off, I'm just going to say I think Numbers suffers from its name. You and I had a brief little conversation about that already. Yeah, bad marketing, I think you said, which I think is really good. So Numbers, yeah, gets last billing sometimes amongst the books of the Pentateuch, which makes sense, I think, at face value. Genesis is incredibly important, and there's lots of exciting things in there with creation and the flood and the patriarchs and the Joseph narrative. And so everybody gets excited about Genesis. Exodus is immensely important for setting the tone for Passover and everything else and what God is going to do with his people for the rest of time. And then Leviticus lays out the priestly code and the people's worship lives, what it means to be God's people and live in a confession and absolution sort of society. And that's a big deal. And then Deuteronomy is Moses' final sermons to the people, but his last words of wisdom, reminding them who they are as God's people and everything he has done for them, reminding them that they are a covenant people and all of those blessings before they are going to take the promised land. And then he will go on to enter his heavenly rest, right? And God himself buries Moses. Deuteronomy is a pretty heavy hitter too. And so that leaves Numbers, a book that we titled after censuses, right?
Blame the Septuagint.
Right. Let's count the people. Okay, they do a couple of censuses. We're going to name it Numbers. We have a numbers of people. But in Hebrew, the title of the book is Bamidbar, so in the wilderness, which is a much better title. It describes the events. There's all sorts of incredible things that happen here. Right? This is where we get the narrative of the serpents biting the people, and then they raise it up on the bronze serpent on the pole, which Jesus references as why him being lifted up on the cross is the salvation of the people. We get Balaam and his talking donkey in Numbers, and there's all sorts of miraculous feedings with manna and water from the rock and the quail. So much quail. There's all these incredible things, and we just, oh yeah, it's that other book in the Torah. It's the other one in the Pentateuch. So that's what it is. It's the wilderness wanderings, right? The people are wandering around between the Exodus and before the conquest. And there's all these incredible things that happen. God is taking care of his people. He's providing for them and all sorts of instruction on what it means to be the people of Yahweh as they figure out their lives and try to pass it on to the next generation. So that's where we're at. That's what's going on in the whole book. As we break it down to this sort of account, the Israelites are preparing to go across the Jordan. They're on the east of the Jordan right now. They're going to go into the western side, go across it to the west to take the land that God has promised them. If we want to put a date on it, 1400 BC roughly, maybe 14, people put exact dates on things, 1407 BC.
Sure.
It's right in there. Okay. That's what's going on.
So roughly 3,400 years ago from where we are. Yeah. I think it's helpful to say dates where we can, if nothing more than just a reminder that we're talking about real events here.
That comes up a lot in this text, the city names and things. It ties us to real people, real places, real events. And that's very important. But to put like an exact year on things, I think sometimes maybe we could have a little bit more humility and say about or around that's all my pitches on that.
Fair enough. So we're approximately 3,400 years before current moment, and the people of Israel are mostly done with their wandering at this point. They're getting ready to go into the promised land. Yep. And the surprise of this chapter, at least for Moses, is that some of the people want to stay on this side. And you can see just from the way I said it there why Moses is going to react the way he does when he gets this request. What do you mean you don't want to go in? Right. We've been there already. So that there's some background to what we're going to read here. As again, they're almost to go over. Moses is about to die, and he gets this request. That's what we're going to read here in Numbers chapter 32. Let's get started. This is Numbers 32, beginning the first verse. Now the people of Reuben and the people of Gad had a very great number of livestock. And they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, and behold, the place was a place for livestock. So the people of Gad and the people of Reuben came and said to Moses and to Eleazar the priest and to the chiefs of the congregation, Ataroth, Dibon, Jazer, Nimrah, Heshbon, Elalah, Sebam, Nebo, and Baon, the land that the Lord struck down before the congregation of Israel, is a land of livestock, for livestock, and your servants have livestock. And they said, if we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants for a possession. Do not take us across the Jordan. But Moses said to the people of Gad and to the people of Reuben, shall your brothers go to the war while you sit here? Why will you discourage the heart of the people of Israel from going over into the land that the Lord has given them? Your fathers did this when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. For when they went up to the valley of Eshcol and saw the land, they discouraged the heart of the people of Israel from going into the land that the Lord had given them. And the Lord's anger was kindled on that day, and he swore, saying, surely none of the men who came up out of Egypt, from 20 years old and upward, shall see the land that I swore to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, because they have not wholly followed me, none except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, and Joshua, the son of Nun, for they have wholly followed the Lord. And the Lord's anger was kindled against Israel, and he made them wander in the wilderness 40 years, until all the generation that had done evil in the sight of the Lord was gone. And behold, you have risen in your father's place, a brood of sinful men, to increase still more the fierce anger of the Lord against Israel. For if you turn away from following him, he will again abandon them in the wilderness, and you will destroy all this people. I'll pause there, that initial interaction between the two. So that takes us through verse 15. All right, so we've got Reuben and Gad, two tribes. Talk to us about their request, the reasoning for their request, any sort of geographical information that might be helpful to understand why this comes.
Yeah, so Reuben and Gad are tribes devoted to shepherding and livestock, as the text tells us. They're what we would call pastoral cultures. And as the nation has just conquered sort of these areas to the east of the Jordan, which would be modern day Jordan, right? The country of Jordan. They're calling it Gilead and Jazer at this time. They notice how wonderful the landscape is for their type of lifestyle, for the livestock, for the herds, for growing things. And so they're like, we're good here. This is nice. I think we could really do well here. So if it's okay, can we stay here? This can be our part of the promised land. And from all accounts, it is a beautiful area. If we look at the geographic descriptions from historians and archaeologists in the last couple of centuries, they talk about Gilead, or what would have been ancient Gilead, still being greatly fertile. We don't always think about that in that part of the world. We think of desert, wasteland, we think of when we think of wilderness. But they talk about all sorts of different trees and fertility and being able to grow everything over there. There's still a lot of towns that have been covered up in desolation and that kind of area, ruins. But they talk about the mountains to the north there, and then they've got great pasture land and grasses in the south area. They talk about lots of trees, oaks to even pistachio trees grow there. They talk about orchards of pomegranates and apricots and olives. It's gentle rural land is how they describe it. It's perfect for herding and growing. The shepherding tribes, they want this land for a reason. It's right up their alley. It's what they do. It's what they know. And so they're making this request.
Okay. And from that perspective, it makes a lot of sense. They even mention some of the specific towns.
And I'm glad you read that part.
So we talked a little bit about the historical reality of these things.
Right,
and,
right.
And these are places, not all of them are perfectly known when you read the text of the scriptures. We're not always positive where they are.
Right.
But in some cases, they're exactly known where they are.
Yeah,
and sometimes
yeah.
they even have a very similar name today. Mm-hmm. So just as an example, while you were talking earlier, I just put into Google Maps the name Dibon.
Yep.
And when you do that, it brings up the city I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correct, Dibon, D-H-I-B-A-N, in the country of modern-day Jordan,
yep.
which is, that's exactly where we're talking about.
Right.
It's a remarkable thing.
Yeah, as you said, they mentioned specific cities, and yes, I'm glad you had to pronounce them and not myself, but these are actual places, and most of those places have either been connected to a modern-day inhabited city, or they've been identified with certain archaeological sites. And you brought up Dibon, which, yeah, they changed the O to an A, and, yes. and that's how that one is. Nimrah has been identified with Tel Belabil and Tel Nimrim. So there you can even see a part of the name crossing over Nimrah to Nimrim. Heshbon is probably, again, just changing the O to an A for modern Heshbon. But this could have been a later name change also as the cities change hands and things like that. We know that Nebo was classically identified with Kirbet El Makatit, which is south of Mount Nebo. And there's even Moabite inscriptions that reference worship of Yahweh associated with that site, which is pretty cool. So again, real history tying us to real events. And then Bayon, which gets mentioned, is a shortening of Baal Me'on, or even Beth Me'on, which we'll get into as we talk about the names changing, right? They change them from the other deities to their own. We're using all sorts of terms here. Maybe I should break some of those down for people.
Yeah.
So some of these place names, they come from common words. So if you see like Beth at the beginning word, it's a city name. Usually it means house. The city is often named house of something or someone. And then El is the general word for God, either with a lowercase g or an uppercase g. And so a name like Bethel means house of God. And then I was also using words like Tel and Kirbet. These are archaeological terms. Both of them refer to a settlement mound. So societies in the ancient world, if you can avoid starting from scratch, you would do that. So you'd use an existing city, an existing settlement, and you just build on top of it. And so they keep rebuilding on top of existing settlements over and over through the generations. And so you get these different ruins and layers, and eventually it becomes a mound. And so the cities would be on top of mounds, on top of ruins, on top of ruins, on top of ruins. And so these are two different words. So a kirbet is a mound with the ruins exposed. They're sticking out of the earth. And then a tel is a mound of ruins that's still completely covered with earth. And so if you hear something like Kirbet Kiafa, that's at the site of Kiafa, they had ruins sticking out of the ground. Or Tel Amarna, it was completely covered, but they knew there was ruins under there. So that's what those are. And so we hear these words connected to these places. It means there have been excavations done at these sites, and they're giving us, again, the names of these sites identified with each of these specific ancient cities. It's not necessarily important that we know which site specifically correlates to which city in the Book of Numbers, but it is important that we know that these research sites are corroborating the biblical narrative, that this is real history connected to real people and real places. So you can actually go visit the places where Moses and Joshua walked. You can go see the places these battles took place. The Bible tells us true events that impacted actual people in a real world. And so that's what we have going on here.
And while this is a bit of a detour from where the text is, it is important for us to realize these things. And it's also a very, I think, an interesting thing for us today, because so often this part of the world is still in our news regularly.
Yeah.
And so you'll hear the names of cities and places said on the news. Oh, I've read about that place in the Bible. It was 3,400 years ago.
Yep.
But I've read about that. And so to know that God is the one who acts in history for the sake of his people and their salvation is such an important feature of the scriptures. And just by knowing a few things about, like you said, Beth, when you see that, think house.
Mm-hmm.
Those are helpful to make those connections for us. This isn't a dead religion by any means. This is the religion of the true living God who works for the sake of his people. So those people here, we have two tribes in particular at this point, Reuben and Gad, who see this good land for shepherding. They think, we're shepherds. Moses, let's stay here. And the way they say it, do not take us across the Jordan.
Right.
Maybe that's what triggers Moses. And we need the history lesson that Moses gives us. Talk to us about this request and then the reason Moses reacts the way he does.
Sure. Regardless of what's going on, they see the fertile land and wanting to preserve and engage in their agrarian pastoral lifestyles, the Reubenites and the Gadites ask if they can settle in these lands east of the Jordan. And yes, Moses does not exactly handle the request very well. He gets a little frustrated and angry. He's downright upset by the request, and he sees it as a lack of faith and a sign of fear, because he's comparing these tribes and their request to the spies that they sent into Canaan in the first place, right? The previous chapters in Numbers 13 and 14, they sent them in to go scope out the promised land for the people, and then the reporting didn't go so well. We even have the Sunday school song, right? Yep. 12 men went to spy on Canaan. 10 were bad and 2 were good. And it goes on and on.
Yep.
And so those two good ones are mentioned, Joshua and Caleb. They're the faithful spies, but their voices are shouted down by the unfaithful, the ones that are scared to go into the land. Oh, and I suppose since we've mentioned Joshua, I would be remiss if I did not get a pastor joke in here. Who is the only person in the Bible with no parents? Joshua, son of Nun. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it's a terrible one, but there you go. Pastor jokes. But anyway, so Caleb and Joshua, the only faithful spies, their voices are lost in the sea of the complaining and the fear from the other tribes. That brought that lack of faith, that fear caused great disheartening amongst all of the people, and they weren't trusting Yahweh to protect them and to help them take the land. And so they weren't able to enter it. The consequences of that was wandering around for decades in the wilderness. They were a nomadic people. They were taken out of Egypt, and now they still can't settle the land that God wants to give them. And they said it was everyone who was 20 or older when they left Egypt. Why is that detailed in there? This was the full age of adulthood and responsibility in ancient Israel. And so only the youngest generation that left Egypt, those that were still children, we're going to have the possibility to enter the promised land now. And so Moses, remembering that and remembering all that he's dealt with the people as they wander through the wilderness for 40 years, he said, you're going to do it again. This is what's going to happen. We can't let this happen. And so he's afraid, right? He's afraid the tribes of Reuben and Gad are just afraid, and that the attitude will again bring judgment on the whole nation. He's trying to protect the people.
Yeah, and I think it's pretty easy when you put yourself in Moses' shoes to see why he reacts this way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
At this point, I think, I'm not positive, but I think based on the way Numbers has gone, that Moses is the only one left of that old generation. I think everybody else has died at this point. Moses is the only one left, and he knows that he's going to die soon. Mm-hmm. And how disheartening would that be? For someone like Moses, who's wandered around for these 40 years, watching all the people of his generation die, knowing that he's tried to be faithful, for a moment of unfaithfulness, he doesn't get to go in. And now here he is, almost about to die, right. And he thinks the same thing's going to happen. I think you put yourself in Moses' shoes, 120 years old, leading Israel for 40 years. This is the way I would react. We did this 40 years ago, guys. Right. We're not doing it again.
He's justifiably concerned, right? It's these tribes not wanting to continue on into the promised land is unthinkable to him. He's seen what happens when the people disregard God's provision and his blessings, right? There was the sending of the snakes, the gorging on the quail when they complained about lack of meat. And of course, yes, the wandering for 40 years. God has always been faithful to the people. So why do they want to keep backing out of his plan for salvation? A land of their own. And so they're right on the cusp. It's right there. The fulfillment is right on, literally on the other side of the river. And they don't want to do it. They're content right here. Moses, fully upset.
And in that sense, he's maybe we shouldn't give him a hard time for the way he reacts. he's reacting as a faithful leader. He has seen these things play itself out over and over again.
Right.
And he says, don't do this again. That's exactly his job for Israel is to tell them, don't do it again.
You cannot forget the promises. You cannot forget what he's done for you. This is the final reward. You're turning your back on it. He doesn't want to see that happen.
That's right. Yeah. So in that sense, this what he says to them here is a precursor to what he's going to preach in Deuteronomy for 34 chapters. Don't repeat the mistakes that you've made. Don't fall into the same sins. Be faithful. And so here he thinks this is time for that sermon. The people are going to reassure him, however, the unfaithfulness that Moses believes is going on is not actually what's happening. So we keep reading now the text to hear what do Reuben and Gad actually have in mind. We're now at verse 16. Then they came near to him. So the leaders of Reuben and Gad came near to Moses and said, "We will build sheepfolds here for our livestock and cities for our little ones. But we will take up arms, ready to go before the people of Israel, until we have brought them to their place. And our little ones shall live in the fortified cities because of the inhabitants of the land. We will not return to our homes until each of the people of Israel has gained his inheritance. For we will not inherit with them on the other side of the Jordan and beyond, because our inheritance has come to us on this side of the Jordan to the east." So Moses said to them, "If you will do this, if you will take up arms to go before the Lord for the war, and every armed man of you will pass over the Jordan before the Lord, until he has driven out his enemies from before him, and the land is subdued before the Lord. Then after that you shall return and be free of obligation to the Lord and to Israel, and this land shall be your possession before the Lord. But if you will not do so, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out. Build cities for your little ones and folds for your sheep, and do what you have promised." And the people of Gad and the people of Reuben said to Moses, "Your servants will do as my Lord commands. Our little ones, our wives, our livestock, and all our cattle shall remain there in the cities of Gilead. But your servants will pass over, every man who is armed for war, before the Lord to battle, as my Lord orders." And I'll pause there again. That takes us through verse 27. Just have a couple minutes here before our break, Pastor Jones. So help us with what's going on at the outset of that section. The people of Reuben and Gad want to reassure Moses what their intention is. Talk to us about their, I don't know if offer is the right word. Talk to us about what they say to Moses.
So they're trying to allay Moses' concerns. And so the tribal leaders make a vow. Right? They're going to make their settlements here on the east of the Jordan. They want to build their folds for their livestock and rebuild the cities for their families here. But they will still send their men to fight alongside their brethren, the rest of Israel. They swear not to return home to their families and their homes until the conquest is completed. And they're going to give up any allotment they may have been given on the western side of the Jordan in exchange for the eastern lands. They're not asking for anything extra. They're going to take this instead. They make that clear. So in a sense, they're making a type of covenant, a legal promise to serve on behalf of their brothers for the rights to this land. They're doing everything they can to help Moses say, that's not what this is. We're not backing out. We want God to bless us, but to do it here.
Yeah. So they tell Moses that first and foremost, their intent is not to rebel against the Lord.
Right.
Their intent is to be a part of the people of Israel who will receive the fullness of the promised land as an inheritance. And maybe just before we go to the break, just as we think about what's going on here, why not just go ahead and take land on the other side? Why here? This is the way that I think the larger picture is showing here, is one, the Lord is already giving to his people even before they get to the part that he's already promised them. So you have this idea, I think, of a foretaste of what is to come.
There you go.
As well as an expansion of what the Lord gives. He said, you're going to get this land. And now he's saying, and you can have this too. Both of which I think make this overall a very positive chapter in the lives of the people of Israel. Not any way of a doubt on the part of these tribes, but rather an increased faith at the way they've already seen God begin to fulfill his promises. And they're already banking on that here before they've even actually gone in.
Yep.
So those are some themes that we'll explore more on the other side of the break with the rest of this text. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking about Numbers 32 with Pastor Rick Jones this morning. We will be right back. Please stick around.
does Lutheran Church Extension Fund serve, you ask? It's simple. We serve Lutheran Church Missouri Synod ministries and church workers with loans and ministry services. And it's faithful Lutherans like you, church members and church workers alike, investing with LCEF that makes it possible for LCEF to serve these ministries. Learn more at lcef.org.
LCEF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCEF investments are not FDIC insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCEF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCEF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Monday, November 11th. We're studying Numbers chapter 32, verses 1 to 42 with Pastor Rick Jones. He serves as chaplain and vice president of spiritual life at the Dakota Boys and Girls Ranch in Minot, North Dakota. Pastor Jones, prior to the break, we were talking about the leaders of Reuben and Gad. They want to allay Moses' concerns. They say, no, We don't intend to forsake our brothers. What we want is to go ahead and build our sheepfolds here, to get our kids settled in the fortified cities, but then we have every intention of going across the Jordan to make sure our brothers receive their inheritance. We won't inherit on that side. We're not trying to take extra land for ourselves. All of these reassurances for Moses so that they would know, or that Moses would know, that they are not rejecting the Lord. They're not rejecting their brothers. They are intending to be faithful to the Lord and his promises. Moses responds then in verse 20, and his tone changes, but he still fulfills that role of being the leader and shepherd of these people. Talk to us about Moses' response in verses 20 and following.
So Moses does accept their vow. He's going to give them a stern warning with it, but he does accept it. And maybe part of that is we jumped over it, and I just thought about this now, but because what's going to happen in the later part, but it says they came near to him. So they approach Moses personally. They're not trying to make him make a scene in front of everybody when they bring this to him, when they bring their earnestness before him. They're appealing to him personally. Hey, we understand your concern. This is what we intend. And so they are able to meet him sort of one-on-one with that. But so he does accept it. He allows them to have this land, provided that they fight faithfully alongside the other tribes during the conquest. And he even says that they will be free of obligation after the task is complete. Now, it's a little unclear, is that just for the conquest, just for one this, or is it for future things too? We don't know exactly, but something sprung in my mind, and I don't remember if it was on your program here or if it was on Thy Strong Word, but I got to do some stuff with Deborah in the Song of Deborah. And Reuben does not join in that crusade against Sisera and Jabin. And there's even verses about it in that song in Judges chapter 5. And so the thought is this a part of that? They're free of obligation, or is it not related at all, and I'm connecting two things that aren't connected? It doesn't matter. But anyway,
yeah, I don't know. Like I wondered about that too. What does that mean that they? And because it says they are free of obligation to the Lord and to Israel, which sounds, especially the thought of being free of obligation to the Lord, in my mind, that makes this a lot more of a temporal one-time thing rather than an ongoing thing. Because when you read the book of Deuteronomy, the rest of like all of God's people obligated to the Lord in the sense that they need to go to the place where he puts his name to worship.
Yeah.
So there will be ongoing obligations that these tribes as a part of Israel will have to the Lord and to their brothers. And because of what comes later, that makes me take these verses in a more temporal way. Once you've finished this, then it's finished. That's the way that I read it.
Right. And that was my initial inkling as well. It was an interesting note to have in there. You're free of obligation.
And to what you've read in Judges, it's been a while since I've studied Judges here. The book of Judges generally doesn't have the most positive examples in it.
No, not at all.
At least my from what I remember of Judges, I would imagine that Reuben not showing up is probably not a good thing.
Right. Yeah. The song throws a little shade on them. It actually mentions them. They took their time deciding what they were going to do, but they were content with their flocks thing. It almost has a condescending tone to it, or at least that's how I read it, maybe.
Well, and okay, yeah. And I know you've studied that more recently, but I do think here's a connection I think we can draw from that by way of contrast.
Yeah.
What strikes me in the book of Judges there is that you do notice the more tribal nature of Israel, and
yes,
they're not always
yes.
working together. The exact opposite is the case here, and I think that's a big part of what Reuben and Gad promise. And what Moses recognizes in their promise is that they are going to stick with their brothers. They are going
right.
to be a part of the whole church. They're not going to divide the church. And
right.
I think that's a really important theme of this chapter and a positive thing that is not always in place later in Israel's history.
Right, which that brings us right into the warning, right? Moses' warning in verse 23, "But if you will not do, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out." When I read that, it brought two things to my mind. And the first one was God's warning to Cain in Genesis chapter 4. But when you just said the obligation to our brothers, it brought the other part of it.
Sure.
Am I my brother's keeper? Yes. Yes, you are your brother's keeper. And so you do this. But what I initially thought was, be careful. Sin is crouching at your door. It wants to devour you, and you must conquer it, right? And so he's giving them that warning. It's the same sort of a thing. You're right. This could go a bad way. You need to make sure you're faithful in this. And then the other piece that it brings to my mind is Jesus' words about making oaths. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. And so also takes that sort of turn too, right? This isn't just about your brothers. This isn't just about the tribes. This is about God. He's amplifying the vow. The tribal leaders focus on their obligation to the other tribes, but Moses emphasizes that this is an obligation to Yahweh. The stakes are high, and faithfulness will be the pivot for the outcome. The other piece with that, let your yes be yes and your no be no. They're not making any special, oh, we swear by the name of the Lord or anything like that. They're just saying, we will do this. We will go to battle before the Lord. We will go to battle with our brothers. So that's interesting too, that there's not some special formula or a thing that they're swearing on. It falls right in line with Jesus' words. No, their yes is going to be yes or their no is going to be no.
Yeah, we've actually heard about vows very recently in the book of Numbers. Back in chapter 30, the matter of vows was talked about. There was instructions given. And the overarching principle for that chapter in Numbers 30, verse 2, if a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. One of the things perhaps that we can think about happening then in Numbers 32 is this is taking place not on an individual level, but on this collective level by way of tribes. You tribes are going to do what you have said. And even Moses, as the leader of God's people, in some way serves a similar role to what happens when, in that same chapter, when a wife takes a vow and when her husband hears of it, he can establish it or he can say, no, this isn't what is good for our family. I think Moses is doing something similar here as he hears this request from Reuben and Gad saying initially, no, this is not good for the people of Israel, but then listening to them and saying, okay, yeah, you're right. And now this vow is established, this promise is established, and you're going to do it. And I think we're seeing a lot of things come together, all in a very positive way. Go ahead.
We're seeing people, as you said, it's an expansion of God's blessings. Yeah, he had this promised land all picked out, but you know what? He always blesses us. And so he will bless you here in this land as well. And Gad and Reuben totally trust that. They have faith in that, but they're not going to abandon their brothers. And so they're acting out on their trust in God by making this faithful pledge. We will be honorable in this. We will do the right thing. We will stand by this because we are with Israel. We are together. And so we see them living out their lives faithfully. It's a great thing. Yeah, it is positive. Yes, Moses was rightfully concerned, but they're putting those concerns, they're laying all of it. They're putting those aside for him. And by living out the life of faith that he's been trying to get them to do the whole time.
That's right. Well, that's another thing about this section of the book of Numbers. Once you get past the second census in chapter 26, the people by and large are very successful and very faithful. Now, of course, we've already mentioned Judges, and we know generations to come are not going to be perfect by any means, and this generation will not do everything faithfully either. But at this critical moment, right before they're going into the Promised Land, they are showing that the Lord has worked on them and has taught them things in the wilderness, and they've taken those teachings of the Lord to heart in faithful ways. And it's a refreshing thing to see, especially in the Pentateuch, where the books of Moses and the people of Israel are usually thought of as, yep, here they go grumbling again. Not always. There are faithful moments for God's people. His Spirit is at work and does work faith and faithfulness among them, and this is one of those spots. Before we leave this section behind, just a little bit more reflection I'd love to hear from you, Pastor Jones, about this, the thought of both the faithfulness to God, which Moses focuses on, but also the faithfulness to the church, to the brothers. Talk a little bit about how those things go hand in hand, that when we are faithful to God, we are also faithful to his church, and vice versa. When we're faithful to his church, we're faithful to God.
So everything we do, or at least this is how we should operate, our actions in life should be a reflection on our faith in God, a reflection of gratitude for all that he provides for us. And so I think that's what we see with these tribes. We know God has taken care of us. We know he has brought us through the wilderness. We know he has done all of these things. He has driven out the people, even of this land, out before us. And so we trust him. We know he's there. We know he's there for us. And we're okay to settle here. We're not going to abandon our brothers. We're still going to live right by them. They are a part of us. We are together in this faith, together in this covenant. We are all covenant people. And they're able to be there to act out of mercy for their neighbor, for their brother, out of that faith that they have for God. And that's what the church is supposed to be, right? We are supposed to be the place of refuge for the widow, the fatherless, and the foreigner. And they're doing that amongst their brothers. They're going to fulfill that. They are going to be their brother's keeper. They're going to stand there, and it's out of that sense of faith, knowing Yahweh has taken care of us, and so we can now help take care of everybody. We're in this together. And they're willing to put their own safety on the line to do it. It's not like only so far. They're going to war, and they're happy to do it. They made this vow, they had the plan, and they executed it. It wasn't just a, hey, maybe we can get Moses to do this thing for us. No, it was absolutely out of that sense of contentment and gratitude for what Yahweh had already provided. These lands are perfect for them. Why would they want to forsake that, even if the promised land, they know it'll be fine, but God's already got them perfectly taken care of right here. They're going to dwell in that with gratitude.
Yeah, you get the sense that had the answer come back from Moses and from the Lord, no, you need to go in. That's where your inheritance is going to be. You have, this is of course speculation because it's not how it went down.
Right.
But it seems that it would fit in this context that they would have said, okay, we will go, you know.
All right.
Yeah. But they make the request, they ask boldly, and the Lord gives just as boldly in this context.
Right.
So as you pointed out, probably what's just happened is more of a private interaction between Moses and the leaders of these two tribes. As the rest of the text plays out, this becomes public. It's an agreement that all of God's people are going to see. So we pick up the text once more in Numbers 32 at verse 28. So Moses gave command concerning them to Eleazar the priest and to Joshua the son of Nun and to the heads of the fathers' houses of the tribes of the people of Israel. And Moses said to them, if the people of Gad and the people of Reuben, every man who is armed to battle before the Lord, will pass with you over the Jordan, and the land shall be subdued before you, then you shall give them the land of Gilead for a possession. However, if they will not pass over with you armed, they shall have possessions among you in the land of Canaan. And the people of Gad and the people of Reuben answered, what the Lord has said to your servants, we will do. We will pass over armed before the Lord into the land of Canaan, and the possession of our inheritance shall remain with us beyond the Jordan. And Moses gave to them, to the people of Gad and to the people of Reuben, and to the half-tribe of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and the kingdom of Og, king of Bashan, the land and its cities with their territories, the cities of the land throughout the country. And the people of Gad built Dibon, Ataroth, Aroer, Atroth Shophan, Jazer, Jogbeha, Beth Nimrah, and Beth Haran, fortified cities and folds for sheep. And the people of Reuben built Heshbon, Elilah, Kiriathaim, Nebo, and Baal Maon, their names were changed, and Sibma. And they gave other names to the cities that they built. And the sons of Machir, the son of Manasseh, went to Gilead and captured it, and dispossessed the Amorites who were in it. And Moses gave Gilead to Machir, the son of Manasseh, and he settled in it. And Jair, the son of Manasseh, went and captured their villages and called them Havoth Jair. And Noba went and captured Kenneth and its villages and called it Noba after his own name. And that takes us to the end of Numbers chapter 32. All right, so we go public in this section, Pastor yep. Jones. Talk to us about what Moses says to Eleazar, Joshua, and the heads of the tribes.
So Moses now takes the arrangement with the tribes and makes it, as you said, public. And he first takes it through the spiritual leader, Eleazar the high priest, who has succeeded his father, Aaron, who passed away a few chapters previously. And now the political and military leader, Joshua, who was named Moses' successor, I believe in chapter 27. And then they're going to bring it to all of the tribal leaders. So it's not just going to be a secret handshake arrangement, right? This isn't just happening in a back room. It's not just a gentleman's agreement. This has got to be official. It has got to be public. Everyone has to be on board with it. It has to be completely known to the whole community. So they're making, again, an official type of covenant here. It's not the same level of covenant that God has, but it is a legal arrangement. And that's why they're repeating it so many times, right? That's part of that legal element. It has been blessed by the leadership. It's been blessed by Moses and the Lord. And so now it needs to be blessed by the whole nation.
Yeah. And so it needs to be known so it can be carried out. Eleazar and Joshua, Moses knows he's about to die. These are the two guys who are going to pick up after he dies. So it needs to be carried out. Everybody needs to know about it for the legality and so that this can actually be executed when the time comes.
Yep. Everyone can be held appropriately accountable and the logistics will work out because everybody's already on board. And then the language usage also shows the seriousness and depth of what this arrangement will mean. They're not just marching to war on behalf of their brothers. They are doing so on behalf of God, on behalf of Yahweh, right? It said, every man who is armed to battle before Yahweh, before the Lord, will pass with you over the Jordan. The pledge is made publicly with these terms, and the tribes accept it, and they bind themselves to it publicly as a vow with God. As they proclaim, what Yahweh has said to your servants, we will do. They fully see this not just as a political arrangement, but this is a spiritual one as well. It's a part of who they are as people of Yahweh, as the covenant people. The whole nation is in this together now, and they've made this vow to do this. We are doing this out of faithfulness and fidelity with everybody here.
Now, as the land starts to be assigned to these tribes in verses 33 and following, there's one detail that shows up that if you know anything about the land and the way it was divided, you might be wondering where this comes. And here it's mentioned, you have Gad and the people of Reuben and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Now, that was the part, as I was reading this chapter, getting ready for our conversation, I was like, I know the Transjordan tribes include the half-tribe of Manasseh. Where are those guys? And then here they are all of a sudden. Perhaps there's another text in the Old Testament that I've forgotten. Where does the half-tribe of Manasseh fit into this? They get land, that's clear, but they've been absent up until this point.
And we don't know exactly. The text, it's a gap, right? It's where did Manasseh come from? Where were they at the table? Where were they when the negotiating happened? Why are they not mentioned till now? We can't be sure. I went through as many commentaries as I could find for that specific question.
Sure.
And no one has a really good answer. My favorite explanation is that perhaps after they saw that the request of Reuben and Gad was acceptable, they too expressed their desire to dwell in these lands to the east of the Jordan. Like it just hadn't occurred to them, this is a possibility even. And so they're like, whoa, we can do this? Awesome. Can we get in on that too? But then what's interesting is, so Manasseh is only a half tribe,
right.
But they have land on both sides of the Jordan. You get the west Manasseh and east Manasseh. And so all sorts of interesting things happen there, right? And as the history of the people continues to progress, all sorts of things change and shift. But really interesting that even the half-tribe gets what looks like bigger amounts of land, but it could be like the way that geography is, it ends up being the same usable land. I don't know. It's just interesting.
The Transjordan tribes are Reuben, Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh.
Yeah.
That's the way we regularly talk about it. And it goes back to Numbers chapter 32. However, Manasseh ended up joining, they do.
Yeah.
And so they begin to inherit. Talk to us about what's said about the land they inherit here in verses 33 and following.
After the public vows, Moses acknowledges the arrangement, and then the land is assigned. And this is actually a different type of assigning of the land than the tribes that will receive it on the other side of the Jordan, because theirs is going to be assigned by lots, so essentially by chance. Spoiler alert for chapter 33, maybe. But here Moses does the assigning. It's not God that's doing it by chance. It's Moses saying, you're going to have this land, you're going to have this area, you're going to have this area, which is really interesting. Moses, instead of God, becomes the agent of assigning. And as he assigns, we see again specific cities, specific places named and distributed. They're designated to each of these tribes. Some of them would change hands in later generations as some tribes grew or shrank, and some are maybe absorbed into others. But that's what's going on here. And then it also makes mention that the Israelites are changing the names of many of these cities. This is because many of those names, as we already talked about, they would have been referencing Canaanite deities or different pagan sorts of things. And they don't want to have their homes and their homelands associated with those idols. So for an example, the Baal Meon, as we mentioned before, would mean something equivalent to dwelling place of Baal. Not exactly a great name for an Israelite settlement, so they would change those things. Some places would change names several times, and it wasn't unusual for a new culture coming in to change the names of those places. So we're just seeing, again, real history, another detail showing us the actual history happening in this narrative.
Yeah, the changing of the names here, I think, at least in part, a contrast to some other naming that we've seen in the book of Numbers, especially in that previous generation. Things were getting named for their unfaithfulness. So
right.
Massah and Meribah recount their unfaithfulness.
Right.
I wish we could get the new names to confirm that suspicion of mine, but I think the reality that they're changing pagan Canaanite names to presumably faithful Israelite names is another indicator of this generation's faithful start. And the other point that I would pick up from what you brought out with the way that the land here is given by the people's request, and on the other side of the Jordan, it will be done according to lot. In both cases, the Lord is the one who is giving the land. He is the owner of the land, the
sure.
giver of the land. And I think, and I don't want to spiritualize or allegorize, but I'll say it like this. I think within this that however the Lord gives to us, whether
right.
he gives in answer to a request that we said, and he says, yes, that is a good gift for you, and I give you that, or if he gives to us by what to us might seem more by chance.
Sure.
In either way, it's a good gift.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think that's spiritualizing. I think it's what I'm trying to say. This is an example of the way the Lord works in history and still in our lives.
That's one of the bigger points of this narrative, I think. He's going to bless us regardless. That's who he is. His hand is one that brings blessing. He does that through his people. So here he's doing it through Moses as opposed to the casting of lots. As some commentators, I think, pushed it too far. They're like, see, God didn't want to have anything to do with the land east of the Jordan. I'm like, I don't think that's what's going on here.
No, I don't think so.
The way it worked, because Moses was the broker for the deal. So he's doing this part of it too.
Now, I really think the idea of the first fruits of the land, I think, is what we're seeing here in part, especially with the mention of King Sihon and Og again, who've already been conquered very handily, and now the people receive their territory. I think you get the idea of the first fruits of the Lord's giving. Even before they get there, right. He's already giving. We got about two minutes or so, Pastor Jones,
yeah.
with a chapter that you're like, okay, this is nice. It's good history. What do we do with it? What's the application for us as Christians?
I think we've alluded to some of this with what it means to that God allowed them to take this land, but I'll just go into some of the things I found. Many commentators, they'll leave the depth of their examination kind of shallow. Sure. Oh, they didn't, they'd say, oh yeah, the Reuben and Gad, they didn't want to go in and be totally faithful. They just wanted to stay there. I think that's not exactly right. And some, they even will allegorize the decisions of Reuben and Gad and make it, this represents the people for whom wealth and comfort in this life become a barrier for faith. And I think, again, that might be a tempting way to go. But the fact that they honor their pledge to help their brothers conquer the land, and that God honors their pledge and makes it their land, that allegorizing of the text is unsatisfying. So I think it is a better way to see this as an example of God meeting his people where they are at. He meets them in their need, and sometimes even in their desires, which is what we have here. The importance of the promised land is not its exact geography. It is that it is the place of rest and refuge for God's people. It is the place he will be present for them and provide for all of their needs. If the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh experience God's blessing in the land to the east of the Jordan, and their lives still demonstrate faith in his promises, then God is going to bless them there. I liken it to the way pastors have to deliberate over calls. They might be extended a call while they're already serving one. Both of these are acceptable choices for them to do. Both are valid calls. Both are going to be engaging in God's ministry. God will bless whichever vocation the pastor chooses. That's how God operates. Whichever vocation is acceptable to that pastor, God is going to see as acceptable, and he's going to bless it with faithfulness and contentment through that service. He meets his people where they are. He provides for them in faithfulness and lets his promises be lived out. This account is, again, a further example of God blessing his people in every situation and every context of this world. And ultimately, it's going to point us to the place where God demonstrates the fullness of his compassion for his people, which is Christ. He does not require us to come into his heavenly presence. He came down into our earthly presence as one of us. God comes down as Jesus, and he saves us and cares for us here in this world, here and now, where we were at. Because of God's faithfulness and divine mercy, as he's demonstrated here by helping out these tribes and blessing their choices and faithfulness, he does so in Christ. Ultimately, what he's showing even here 3,400 years ago is that there truly is a balm, even in Gilead.
Pastor Rick Jones serves as chaplain and vice president of spiritual life at the Dakota Boys and Girls Ranch in Minot, North Dakota. He's been helping us today to study Numbers chapter 32, verses 1 to 42. Pastor Jones, thanks for being our guest today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Always a great time.
I am your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about Numbers 32, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It is always a joy to hear from you. Join us tomorrow as we keep reading in the book of Numbers. We're getting close to wrapping things up, and Moses starts to wrap things up as he recounts Israel's journey toward where they are at this very moment. Join us tomorrow to hear that. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk with you again tomorrow.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to kfuo.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to kfuo.org/store.